You're listening to Critical Reads. This show is designed to help people critically analyze topics like race, culture, and faith, one resource at a time. I am your host, Neff Lesperance. Hi, everyone, and welcome to another exciting episode of Critical Reads, the podcast. As the intro says, I am your host, Neff. So for those of you who are newer to the show, welcome to it. And for those of you who have been listening for a while, thank you for just taking the time to tune in to these episodes. And it's always exciting to see every few days how many people have, you know, been downloading and listening to this. I never set out to really have a lot of people download this like crazy, even though it would be nice. But it's just nice, I think, in general to know that I'm not just speaking to myself every week and there are some people out there that are interested. So for those of you who have been listening and for those of you who have been sharing and rating and all that stuff, thank you so much for doing that. And I really appreciate it. So today for this episode, we are going to be talking about a movie entitled Rent. This was a musical drama film that was created by this guy named Chris Joseph Columbus. This movie was interesting because it was an adapted version of Rent that was kind of based off of this guy named Jonathan Larson's version of it that they did on Broadway. So I am excited to talk about this movie, even though I know most of you out there are probably like, really, Rent? That could be a resource. But if you are patient with me, I will explain my reasoning and my thoughts behind doing this movie as a resource. But before we get there, I wanted to just do a quick musings of a Tara Black social worker for this week. As a lot of you may know, every week I like to do this segment just to kind of take some time to reflect on something that's interesting or that caught my attention. Sometimes it's something that kind of also makes me laugh or infuriated, I should say. And so I wanted to just talk a little bit about something that I saw on TikTok that kind of made me laugh. So apparently there's a lot of conversations on TikTok about interracial dating and the implications of that. And obviously, I know being a Black woman, there's always conversations about, okay, if a Black man decides to date somebody who is non-Black, a lot of the times there's some conflict, not necessarily because that Black man is dating somebody that is non-Black. It's more so because while they're doing that, they take the time to degrade Black women and be like, well, you see, this is why we're not picking a Black woman because X, Y, and Z, but this non-Black person does this better type of thing. And so I know for me, that's something I've always been like, ugh, that's so annoying, especially as a Black woman to hear that. And then I know a lot of different races kind of struggle with it, but I know in terms of like, there are some non-Black men who are POCs as well that do that to their own people. So like, for example, Latino men may do that about their Latino women, or Middle Eastern men may do that about their Middle Eastern women. So it's just, that's always been an interesting conversation for me, because I'm like, look, like, marry and love who you want, but you don't have to degrade somebody else to make yourself feel better about your choice, right? And then so another trend that kind of came up, which is what I'm going to talk about today, is this idea of like the activist to white spouse pipeline. I never heard of that before, but it made me laugh because especially when we look at people like Kamala Harris, Justice Brown, it was just really funny to see, like, obviously they both are with white men. And of course, there was a lot of commentary about that. And I saw particularly there was one Black man that was like outraged and was like, how does this set an example for like other Black women and blah, 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 blah. And I don't know, for me as a Black woman, as I was like watching that on TikTok, it was just something that first it kind of made me laugh because I trying to strive to be a social justice warrior. I want to be an activist in a lot of ways, even though you know, it comes with its challenges. So first I laugh because I'm like, oh God, does that mean it might be me too that's in this activist role that might end up with a white spouse? And again, if God has it for me to be with a white guy, it's not like I'm gonna be like, oh God, no. Like I'll still give it a chance because again, I do believe that love is love, and whoever loves me well and we match, like regardless of their skin tone or their background, like I want to see what we can do to make that work, right? But first, like I said, I was kind of like, oh God, will this be me? But then it was just an interesting moment again, where it's like, again, reflecting on being a Black woman and just sometimes feeling like almost every other race doesn't usually want me or usually wants to be with me. And to see that these women, yes, they happen to be married to white men, but to see how these white men were like loving them and supporting their dreams and not talking trash about them behind their back. I don't know. To me, again, I'm like, that's the goal, right? Not to say that there aren't Black men who would do that, but it just so happened that whoever they fell in love with was doing that. And so I think for me, when I think about interracial dating and just dating in general, I'm always like, I encourage everybody, like, it doesn't matter like who it is that you fall with, but as long as you fall in love with somebody that's really encouraging your goals and encouraging your dreams, just treating you as an equal, making you feel excited to see them every day. At the end of the day, I'm like, that's the goal, you know? That's what a lot of us, we strive for. And so again, I think like there can constantly be conversations around some of the benefits of dating a Black person if you're Black, or some of the benefits of being with a Latino if you're Latino. But again, at the same time, I think sometimes like you can't help who you mesh with and who you love and who you feel like they're really bringing you up and encouraging you where you need to be encouraged. So I think the key a lot of this time is just to make it work, right? And I say this thinking about like I have friends who are interracially in a relationship, and yeah, sometimes it is challenging to like, especially if they're a person of color, to interact with their in-laws and try to figure out what that looks like. And maybe sometimes their in-laws saying racist stuff and they have to navigate that with their partner. And again, as long as your partner is willing to stand beside you in all of this, like at the end of the day, I'm like, it is what it is. So, but yeah, but like I said, this little blurb or this little comment that I saw really made me laugh again, especially because as somebody who is working towards social justice and trying to be an activist, I was like, oh God. But again, like I said, whatever God, the universe, whatever has for me, like I want to make that work with my partner, especially if he's someone that really loves and supports me and I'm able to do the same with him. But it never ceases to amaze me just the funny shit that I see on TikTok, and I'm learning so much from the dialogue that's happening on there, even though there's sometimes like some of the dialogue I'm like, oh, it's toxic out here, right? But for the most part, like I really am encouraged and I learned so much from the dialogue that's on TikTok. So again, this was just something that kind of stood out to me and made me laugh, and I wanted to share some of my thoughts on that. So, without any further ado, let's get to the episode about Rent the Musical. So, like I mentioned in the top of this podcast episode, today we are going to be doing Rent, which was a musical drama film that was created by Chris Joseph Columbus. He was a director. I know normally when I do films, I tend to have my good friend Diane on this podcast, but just for the sake of her sanity and everything else, I did not have her on because Rent is not really one of her favorite movies. And so, for those of you out there that are like, what do you mean? Is it because there's some homophobia? Blah, blah, blah. No, Diane is not on that shit at all. It's just, this movie is not her cup of tea, but she loves other stuff like Pose and all stuff because of how they're done. this movie just didn't reach like her caliber of things that she enjoys, which is fair. I think we all have our things that we love and the things that we don't like, right? So please don't feel offended that she didn't like this movie, just in case that was something that popped into your mind. But I wanted to talk about this movie because I know for me, this was one of the first few things that I saw when I was younger that exposed me to the ideas around homelessness, drug use, and also the LGBTQ community and the things that they were dealing with, especially during the AIDS epidemic, right? So for me, I wanted to talk about this movie a little bit, just so I can, again, highlight how things like film and even like musicals can really help you critically analyze the world around you and think about things and hopefully encourage you to do more research about certain topics that you're not aware of. So in some ways, this movie kind of did that for me. So before I go deeper into that and what that looked like for me, I'm going to do what I do every week and just intro the movie a little bit and then also intro the creator slash producer. So very quickly, I will read a little bit from Sony Pictures and then I'll do a little bit of the blurb about the director. So Sony Pictures says the following about Rent. Set in New York City's gritty East Village, the revolutionary rock opera Rent tells the story of a group of bohemians struggling to live and pay their rent. Measuring their lives and loves, these starving artists strive for success and acceptance while enduring the obstacles of poverty, illness, and the AIDS epidemic. Rent is based on Jonathan Larson's Pulitzer and Tony Award-winning musical, one of the longest-running shows on Broadway. The raw and riveting musical stars Rosario Dawson, Taye Diggs, Wilson Germain, Heredia, Jesse L. Martin, Idina Menzel, Adam Pascal, Anthony Rapp, and Tracy Toms, and is directed by Chris Columbus. So that's Sony Pictures. And so now we're going to talk a little bit about Chris Columbus, who helped direct this movie. So from what I found, the description says the following. Chris Joseph Columbus is an American filmmaker. Born in Spangler, Pennsylvania, Columbus studied film at Tisch School of the Arts, where he developed an interest in filmmaking. After writing screenplays for several teen comedies in the mid-1980s, he made his directorial debut with a teen adventure, Adventures in Babysitting, in 1987. Columbus gained recognition soon after with the highly successful Christmas comedy Home Alone, which was, you know, developed in 1990, and its sequel, Home Alone 2, Lost in New York, which was developed in 1992. The comedy Mrs. Doubtfire, which was created in 1990, which came out in 1993, starring Robin Williams, was another box office success for Columbus. He went on to direct several other films throughout the 1990s, which were mostly met with lukewarm reception. However, he found commercial success again for directing the film adaptations of J.K. Rowling's novels Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone in 2001 and its sequel Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets in 2002, which were his highest-grossing films to date. In addition to directing, Columbus was a producer for Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban, which came out in 2004, and the drama The Help, which came out in 2011. He also directed the fantasy Percy Jackson and the Olympians, The Lightning Thief in 2010, and the 3D action comedy Pixels in 2015. Columbus is the founder of 1492 Pictures, a film production company that has produced some of his films since 1995. More recently, he co-founded another production firm with his daughter in 2014 called Maiden Voyage Pictures. In 2017, he launched ZAG Animation Studios alongside Michael Barnathan, Ham Saban, and Jeremy Zag. So that's a little bit about Mr. Chris Columbus. It's so hard to not want to call him Christopher Columbus and just think about Christopher Columbus from the past, but whatever, his parents like that name for him. But it's cool to read this because there's, first of all, I always loved Home Alone and Home Alone 2. And to know that those were made basically in 1990, which was the first one, which was like the year of my birthday, and then 92 was my sister. So to know that these movies are so popular and they were kind of produced around the time of my birth and my sister's birth, that's crazy. But again, to just see all the stuff that he's known for, especially since these are a lot of movies and films that I enjoy, that's pretty cool. And then for him to be a part of Rent, which again, I've enjoyed, it's always a cool feeling to just kind of see what these people have been up to and to know that they have created some things that qualify them to just create some cool content. So that was a little bit about the movie and the creator. So for the next part, I'm going to talk a little bit about why I decided to do this movie, or what kind of drew me to this movie. And to be honest, part of why I ever decided to watch this movie was because, as I've mentioned a few times on this podcast, I grew up in a evangelical Christian space. I went to an evangelical Christian school. And basically, by the time this movie came out, I think I was like in ninth grade or so. And I remember there was a teacher or somebody that was like so upset that this movie came out, and so upset that the queers and people who are on drugs and all this stuff are being represented in film. And I remember there was still a lot that I was kind of placing together in my mind as a kid, and I didn't really know how to put it into words, I guess. But I remember thinking, like, what's the big deal? I mean, I don't understand what the big deal is. And I know as I got older, I was like, yeah, but isn't this like real life? Like, you know what I mean? Like, I think a lot of the times, one of the things I struggle with Christians is like, we pretend that people aren't living like real ass lives with real ass struggles. We try to act like just because we decide to follow God that it magically erases all these struggles. And so I know for me, I've always felt like that kind of does a disservice to our faith and the abilities of what we can do in a church community. Because at the end of the day, whether you're a Christian or not, nobody's immune from dealing with the things of life that make us human, right? So whether that be like emotions, bills, sickness, health, marriage, relationships, sexuality, sex, like all these different things, like we are all trying to navigate through it. You know what I mean? And just because you choose to be a follower of Christ or not, it doesn't immune you from the things that come along with that. Sometimes it's a good thing, sometimes it's a bad thing. And so I think for me, as I was trying to make sense of my life and my faith, and I'm just growing and learning as a little child, like, again, there's something about them being like, oh, don't watch that. I was just like, what? Because again, like, there's so many people within their church spaces that deal with these things that are represented in this movie. So I didn't get that. And then whether or not you are deciding to be in the church space or not, these people are also human, right? So to me, I felt like there was a responsibility to reach out to communities that are dealing with AIDS, reach out to communities that are LGBTQ, reach out to the communities that are dealing with homelessness, right? But instead, I feel like the church would often look at those things as, oh, it's like their own moral failing, and it's like they deserve to be that way. And I never subscribed to that BS. So I think when I started to learn a little bit more about this movie and what it was about and all that stuff, I was like, nah, I'm going to watch it. And I think especially the fact that there was people telling me not to watch this movie, I think there's part of me that was like, oh, you're telling me not to do it? Fine, I'm going to do it anyway. And so that was part of what drew me to watching this movie a little bit, just like the being told the no in some ways, which is hilarious. But at the same time, I think there was a part of me also that just wanted to just kind of understand more about these communities that were being depicted in this movie. And again, I know a good part of this movie kind of focuses on peoples who are living with HIV and AIDS. But this movie also touches on, you know, what it looks like to be an artist, what it looks like to be homeless, what it looks like to struggle with like poverty, what it looks like to also deal with classism. Because one of the characters in here is like, wow, you are being, you know, elitist type of thing. And so we see through all of these different characters, different tensions, I feel like. And I think that's part of why I do like this movie, you know, along with the, you know, music, even though there are some songs that I'm like, this song is corny as hell. But I do like the movie because you can see so many different tensions happening throughout this film. And it kind of forces you, if you're willing to, I would say, to kind of ask yourself some questions about what really brings people to these different positions in life and what can we do to help alleviate some of the needs that people who are homeless, people who have HIV AIDS, people who are starving artists, people who are LGBTQ, like what are some things we can do to help their worlds, you know, become a little bit better. And so I know for some people that is uncomfy, but for me, I think that was part of what I liked about this movie is it forced me to think about some of this stuff because it was nowhere near my scope or my vision in 2005. I think 2005, I was just starting ninth grade and I was going to be 15 that year. So definitely this wasn't in my scope. So I really enjoy this movie because of that. It started to put these things in my mind a little bit, right? And so very quickly, I'm going to try to go through the plot and just kind of talk about some of the things that kind of stood out to me. And the way that I'm going to do this is kind of by going through each of the songs that they sing and kind of talk about some of the scenes surrounding that. So I hope that kind of helps with the flow of this episode. And also helps with you guys kind of being able to track where I am in the process of doing this. So first, I will say, just to give some background, this movie first starts out by letting us know that it's Christmas Eve in 1989. And one of the main characters named Mark, who is an aspiring filmmaker, is kind of showing us like, hey, I am going to be trying to do a documentary. Like you kind of see like part of his idea around really creating something meaningful is that he wants to do a documentary kind of highlighting some things without a script. And later on, you get to know a little bit more about what that documentary is going to entail and whatever. But a lot of it is he wants to capture the homelessness around this community, what it looks like for some of these people that he knows around him who are living with HIV. Like, so that's kind of the setting of this movie, right? And so from here, like as the movie begins, the cast, you see full cast, they start singing Seasons of Love as part of their intro. And I really love this song because I like this idea that they bring up about like really measuring somebody's life, like not necessarily by how much money they're making, how much power they have or any of that stuff, but like really measuring the person's life by their relationships, like who they know, who they love. And I think that really is captured a lot in this movie, especially because somewhere along the way, unfortunately, they do lose somebody. But you see, like, it's not just about like romantic relationships, right? It's about friendships. It's about supporting other people. It's yes, there's some things about romantic relationships, but ultimately, it's about them spreading love like with each other and to other people, right? So that's something that I loved off the bat with this movie, this idea of Seasons of Love, and really thinking about what it looks like to leave a good impact, right? Because I know for me, that's something that's so important to me and my journey and my walk on this earth, is that I don't want to leave behind a legacy where people are like, ugh, Neff, like, thank God she's gone. You know what I mean? Like, my heart is really to just love people well and be someone that you can go to be like, okay, I can rest with her. I can lay my burdens down with her, and she will sit with me and really like love me through whatever I'm going through. And so I think that's why for me, just off the jump, this song is just like, oh, I love this song because of that. It's a reminder of like things that I want to be in other people's lives and just in general, right? And then I think just a small comment is like, I love the voices of especially the two Black people, the Black guy and the Black girl. Like later on, there's a song that they sing that I'm like, ah, this feels like church, but I love their voices, and just that their voices mixed with the rest of the cast. It's just such a powerful song for me. So after this song, Seasons of Love, when you see the cast or the main cast, we go into this song called Rent, where you see Mark and Roger. So Mark was the one that was trying to be a film producer or filmmaker. Roger's his roommate, who we find out later used to be a performer, like he was in a band. He also has HIV, and they both, you know, Mark and Roger both live together in this building, and they're both faced with an eviction notice from their former friend, Benny, who used to live with them and promised that once he got married that he was going to let them stay at this place rent-free without them paying. But now they're having to pay. And so like this, the whole scene just shows, I feel like, the conflict between like what it looks like to be an artist, what it looks like to kind of have a living wage. And then also you kind of start to see a little hints of classism kind of happen too, because I was cracking up. You're hearing about how Benny, you know, used to live with them and he used to be their very close friend. He used to be supportive. He used to be all of these different things. But as soon as he got married and started having money, he just becomes like, just brand new, right? And you kind of get to hear more about that in the next song you'll see. But with Rent, I really did enjoy that song, just watching everybody like burn shit to kind of figure out how to get heat into their houses, and just seeing how like desperate everybody is to kind of keep shit afloat, but then also continue their lifestyle of like trying to create art and be true to themselves, right? And you know, again, I think as somebody that kind of enjoys creating and want to be a creator in my own ways, I identified with them. I was like, man, that sucks. And I know with me, I'm kind of lucky that I could stay with my parents for now. But yeah, I really was like able to start seeing glimpse of like, man, it is really hard, especially if you're a person that lives in New York during this time trying to make things work, right? And unfortunately, as we're hearing a little bit about what's going on with the rent and how they have to pay, you also end up seeing that one of their close friends, Tom, ends up getting mugged. He at some point of the song like called out, was like, hey, I'm gonna come up to the house, whatever. So Mark throws down the keys, and then while he's like trying to walk over to the place, he gets mugged by some people. So that was kind of sad. And then after we start transitioning out of this rent song into You'll See, here we kind of start to see Benny. We kind of start to see a little bit more about their dynamic, what happened between Benny, Mark, and Roger. And basically, Mark and Roger are calling Benny out and saying, like, man, you used to have a heart. You used to really care about people in the community. Now you're changing because you had money. You're basically acting brand new. And again, so I think for me, as I was watching this again, as I've gotten older, I think through Benny's character, you kind of see a little bit about, like, some of the conflicts that happened between like when you're, you know, a person that's dealing with homelessness, and then you also have to deal with like landlords and how elitist and classist they can be and how unwilling to bend they are about making sure that you're okay, because their main concern is like, I want to get my project completed. I want to make money and do what I need to do, even if that means, getting rid of you or getting you out of my way type of thing, right? So in Benny's relationship with everybody, you kind of see that. And I think one thing that really stood out to me when I was watching this recently for the podcast was there is a point before Benny and Mark and Roger start talking where there is a homeless guy like kind of chilling on his car and he's just like, shoot, get away. And so for me, it was again a reminder of like how easy it is for us to forget that people who are struggling with homelessness, they're people who also need things. But at the same time, we're like, we would rather like push them away, get them out of the way so we don't have to see them. And the fact that he didn't want that guy to be like touching on his car. And like, again, you see that glimpse of like classism and elitism through his character. So basically with the song, you'll see Benny basically tries to talk Mark and Roger into canceling a protest that is being done by a mutual friend of theirs named Maureen. We do find out later that Maureen and Mark were actually together, like they were dating before. But with Maureen's protest, she is trying to stop Benny's like construction of a building that he wants to do, which is basically like a studio that he wants to put together. But creating this studio means that he's gonna end up evicting a lot of homeless people because I guess they have like a little tent city for them. It's like very similar, I guess, to like Skid Row or something like that's in California, where like basically a group of homeless people are living in a parking lot area near the place that he's at, right? So he wants them out of the way so he can build that. And so basically he's trying to talk Mark and Roger into talking her out of doing the protest. And they, of course, refuse. And Benny is like basically trying to be like, hey, like if you do this, then I'll waive your rent indefinitely, right? So that scene is kind of left that way. And we are left with this information about what Benny's trying to do, and then also the fact that Mark and Roger are obviously kind of against the way he's thinking. And we know that moving forward, when Maureen does actually have this event, there's a chance that cops might be there and it might turn into a thing, right? So that was that part. So moving forward from this song, you'll see we start transitioning to Angel and Tom. So Tom, again, is a friend of Roger and Mark and Benny. They all used to live together at some point. And Tom is the guy that got beat up in the alley when he was trying to go up to Mark and Roger's place in the song Rent, like a part of that segment. And there's this guy named Angel who's like beating on like a box or like a bucket. And while he's beating, he hears Tom like kind of groaning in the alley. And so he stops. He offers to help because he also notices that Tom is bleeding. And Tom kind of reluctantly accepts the help. And while Angel's helping him get up and they start kind of chatting, they both kind of end up revealing to each other that they both have HIV. And Angel shares with him that he's been going to a support group for help, and Tom ends up agreeing to eventually go with him. So that's kind of the beginning of their story together. From then, you kind of transition to the next song, One Song Glory. Here, I feel like this song is a little sad because you get to hear a little bit more about Roger's story. And again, Roger is a former band member of some kind of rock group, which they don't really go into much detail about. But he ends up contracting HIV. And you can tell just from the beginning before this song starts that he's been really depressed. He stays in the house all the time. He's just kind of learned to seclude himself from everybody and anything right now. And his friend Mark obviously is like, hey, like you need to get out of the house more. You need to get out of the house more. And he continues to decline. And then when Roger starts singing the song One Song Glory, you get to see a little bit of his backstory in that, like I said, he was in a band, he met this girl, both of them got into a relationship together. They both were also struggling with the heroin addiction and they were using the needles, obviously. And as time goes on within the short little montage, you end up seeing that Roger unfortunately contracts AIDS, and so does the girlfriend. And the girlfriend, which I don't think they show in this latest version of it that I saw, but I know the girlfriend essentially dies by suicide. And so obviously for Roger, since he knows that AIDS is something that can eventually take his life as well, he essentially is like, man, I just want to be able to write at least one more song before I might have to pass away from this thing, which is really sad. Every time I think about the song, I'm like, man, there's just so much to unpack. But at the same time, it's like, it's nice to see this man share some vulnerabilities that you don't really get to see him share with like his friends, right? So you get to see some of his vulnerable side and what's kind of making him feel depressed. The fact that he can't write this song, like he wants to do something, but he can't write it. And I know there's points in this movie where his friend Mark kind of jokes about, oh, you've been writing this song for so long. But I know for me as someone who deals with depression, if you have something really weighing you down, it's hard to even think about writing stuff. So I kind of related to him. And so after you hear this song, we get to the next song, Light My Candle. And in this song, we are introduced to Roger and Mark's downstairs neighbor named Mimi, who is a exotic dancer who is also a heroin addict. And it's so funny because when I first heard the song, Light My Candle, part of me thought it was like some kind of euphemism for like hooking up or like trying to get together, because it's very obvious that they have some chemistry between them from the beginning. And then like she keeps blowing out a candle that she has in her hand and like obviously being suggestive and flirty with him, right? But then as I was doing some research on this movie and like just trying to understand more of the plot and all that stuff, I basically found out that the point of this song is that she's trying to convince this guy, Roger, to do heroin with her again. And so, and obviously at this point, like Mimi has no idea that he was a former addict or that he does have HIV. And then we do end up finding out that she has HIV as well. So nobody knows any of this stuff about each other, right? But I thought it was very interesting that that was the goal. Because the whole time I'm like, oh, I thought they just wanted to hook up with each other, right? But no. And it was really interesting as I was doing some, again, research on this. And I wondered why Light My Candle was maybe such a significant thing. And I think my guess is that because heroin is often cooked like in a spoon over like a tea light candle, I wonder if that's part of why they purposely named the song this, right? So that was something that I was like, oh, that's kind of cool and like smart. And so I like this song even more now that I learned more of what was behind the scenes maybe about this. And I could be completely wrong. I know that in high school we used to do all these readings and stuff, and we would guess what all these really old and dead literary people meant when they said, oh, the sky is blue. It was like, oh, was the feeling blue? Was it really the sky was blue? So I know I'm making some assumptions, but again, I thought it was really cool that they kind of used this idea of Light My Candle because it's connected to heroin use, right? And so, yeah, so obviously Mimi's over here giving her best to try to get him into this habit with her, like so that they can both use together. And over again, basically Roger's like, no, girl, this is not going to happen. And so eventually, after their back and forth in the song, Mimi ends up leaving and she takes her heroin with her. And it's assumed that like she goes and does it by herself. And so after this, we get to the next song, Today For You. And so here it's like the next morning, Roger and Mark are both kind of like sitting down at the breakfast nook, and they're seeing that Benny ended up turning back on the electricity, because one of the things we learned in the beginning of the movie is that Benny turned off the electricity to make a point. And it was crazy because, again, it was like New Year's Eve when this movie is starting. So on New Year's Eve, he turns off electricity, which is nuts. And so the electricity is turned back on. Mark's mother ends up calling, leaving him a voicemail and embarrassing him a little bit. And it's funny because here's where you start to learn that Maureen, who is the person that's going to have the event that's coming up for the protest was actually his ex-girlfriend, like I mentioned before, but she actually left Mark for another woman named Joanne. So, of course, like his friend Roger is kind of laughing about it because the mom's like, oh, I can't believe she left you. And like she's saying all the embarrassing stuff that moms say. And so that cracked me up. And then we get a small glimpse of conversation between Mark and Roger about Mimi, because Mimi basically writes a note on their window saying, hey, let's have brunch together or something tonight. And of course, because Mark is trying to get Roger out of the house, he's like, hey, you should do it. You know, why not? She's a downstairs neighbor. She's cute. You know, all these things. You should do it. And of course, Roger again says no. And so once we start transitioning to the next number, which I mentioned a little bit ago today for you, basically from here, Tom ends up coming back over with Angel to the house. And Mark and Roger are like, what the hell happened to you? we threw down the key like a day ago with this, the first number. Like, where are you? Where did you go? And Tom ends up revealing to them that basically he got his ass beat, and then Angel ended up helping. And Angel also ends up being like a benefactor in a way that ends up helping them out with like giving them some alcohol. Like he brought alcohol, he brought some cheeses, some other things. And I do love this number of today for you because basically you hear a little bit about Angel's story and how Angel ends up coming into some money because she helped a rich lady get rid of a dog that had been barking like crazy and keeping her up. It's kind of awful to think about the fact that a dog probably died because, you know, ultimately it's kind of revealed that Angel has been using his skills of drumming to kind of make that dog yip so much that he ends up falling off a ledge and passing away, which is not funny. But I just thought it was funny that I'm like, this is really what we're adding to this movie, but whatever. No dogs were really harmed in the making of this movie, but I thought that was funny that they did that. But that is basically how Angel ends up coming into some money, and then Angel is using some of his money to help people. And also one thing to note is we end up learning a little bit also about Tom's experiences, and he ends up telling the group that basically he came back from MIT because he got kicked out for one of the topics that he wanted to do for his like thesis or his dissertation or whatever. And so instead of him finishing his dissertation at MIT, he's back in New York to teach at NYU. And so it's kind of implied that he might be able to live back either with the guys or I don't know. I mean, later you kind of find out that he's going to be staying with Angel a little bit more. But again, it was cool because you get to hear a little bit more about Tom's background. So after this song today for you, we get to hear a little bit more about everything that's going on with Maureen and her new girl, Joanne. And the way that we start getting into that is through the song called Tango Maureen, which is actually one of my favorites because I just like the sequence of events, or like I guess the montage and the dance, because they do tango dancing in this one. So I do like that. But essentially, Maureen ends up calling Mark, asking him for help to fix some of the tech issues that are going on. And so Mark ends up deciding to go, even though the group is like, what are you doing? If you're not with her, you don't have to feel like you have to go. But it's very obvious to the group that he still loves her. And so he feels like he needs to go, even though obviously you're not together, so it's not like he has to go, but he feels like he needs to go, so he goes. And during this time before he leaves, Tom and Angel end up inviting Mark and Roger to kind of attend Life Support, which is like a support group for people who have AIDS. Obviously Roger is like, no, I'm staying home, but Mark is like, yeah, after I go help Maureen, I'll go to this. So Mark ends up going to try to help Maureen. And while he's walking into the building, he notices, crap, Maureen isn't even here. It's Joanne. And so as they're kind of trying to figure out what's going with the tech stuff, of course, when Mark enters the building, Joanna's like, no, what the hell? Like, why is she here? But then she realizes that basically Joanne has no other option but to get help from Mark, right? So she takes the help, and while they're trying to figure out the stuff, they end up bonding through the song Tango Maureen, how even though Maureen was with each of them at some point, she has like kind of like a wandering eye. Like she has like a need for like getting attention from whether it's a guy or girl, from people. And so she has, it's been challenging for Joanne to kind of be in a relationship with her and not feel insecure in a way, because Maureen is like trying to get attention, right? And so during this, of course, it's revealed that Mark is like, yep, she used to do this with me too, right? And I did kind of laugh because at some point of this interaction, I felt like Mark kind of made like a face like, oh yeah, like you're kind of getting back something that I experienced. So it's like he was being kind of smug about it. So the petty side of me kind of laughed. But again, I did love this song because I love the dance sequence. I loved like some of the choreography. I love dancing and stuff. So I thought this was a cool sequence. And then after Mark fixes the tech issues and all that stuff, it is really funny that Maureen ends up calling and calls Joanne Pookie, which is something that basically Mark was saying, yeah, Joanne, you better be careful because like Maureen used to call me Pookie when she was kind of like, I don't know, it's implied like when she was trying to get away with stuff, like she would call him Pookie. And Joanne was like, no, that's not happening to me. And then she ends up getting called Pookie when Mark is leaving. And Mark again was like, had this smug face. So I was dying at that. But yeah, so Mark leaves. He goes to the life support group. And I thought something that was interesting about this is that I thought he was just going to go and sit and chill and like listen to the stories and whatever. But he ends up asking the group, like, is it okay if I record, right? And I know for me, being very introverted, being very unwilling to like talk about stuff, I was kind of like, I don't know if I would want somebody to record me, especially if I'm in like a group, I don't know, group therapy or a peer group type thing. But this group of people was very open and like, sure, that's fine. And part of me kind of wondered if it's because they knew that they were living with HIV and people didn't really care about their situation. So they're like, at least somebody cares and is trying to document it. Like I kind of did a lot of reading into the situation probably, but I think that was one of the scenes that really stood out to me. And then I think one of the things that I thought was really good that the director did is they've had different kinds of people in the room with HIV. Because I think a lot of the times when we do talk about HIV, people are like, oh, it's only the gays and whatever. And to me, I'm like, look, even if it was just the gays that had this, it doesn't eliminate the fact that they're human beings that deserve the best care and to be loved and all this stuff. But whatever, people are bigoted. You do see that, again, yes, there are people in the room that are LGBTQ, but there was also women. There was also straight men as well. You know, there was different colors as well. So it wasn't just like, oh, it's only Black women that get this. It's not, it's only this type of person. It was like all over the spectrum. And I even imagine that it was people of a bunch of different socioeconomic standings as well, right? Because that is the reality of AIDS, like in HIV. Like it doesn't just hit one type of person. It may be prominent in a certain area because like maybe there's not a lot of care. Like I think of like when you think about like, for example, with COVID, right? Like COVID was hit in certain areas, certain ways recently because there wasn't a lot of help in those areas. But at the same time, COVID was hitting everybody. It didn't care who it was hitting, it was just hitting everybody. So that's kind of how I think about HIV and AIDS, right? Like if you catch it, it hits everybody. So that's something that I did appreciate about this scene is like, again, you get to see so many different types of people and how it affected them. And ultimately, they just wanted a shot to life and to be able to love people and to live, right? And so from here, after this life support group. We go to the next song out tonight. I really love this number as well, because first you open to Mimi dancing at the Cat Scratch Club, which is where she does her exotic dancing. And she's like basically just singing about how she really wants to like go out. Like she has an itch to go out and do something wild, I guess, right? And during this time, like she eventually leaves the club, goes back to her apartment, and she tries to make an advance towards Roger and invite him to go out with her, right? And her way of advancing towards him, obviously, eventually is like kissing him, and he kisses her back. But then we quickly then transition to another song called Another Day, where basically Roger ends up being like, nah, we ain't doing this. And you kind of see like this back and forth that he's having internally with himself, where parts of him wants to interact with her, go out, have fun, let loose, like not let life break him down as much. But then at the same time, he's like, no, I can't do this. And you almost, at least for me, since I know the movie, I feel like there was almost even a tension of him wanting to tell her his story and tell her a little bit of why he's not wanting to participate and all that stuff. But again, he kind of is like, no, I'm not doing this. You need to get out. And so finally, he kicks her out. And Mimi goes into the hands of their friend group because they happen to be outside when she like leaves the building. And that's that. So we know that's not going to happen. And then from here, we transition again to another support group meeting where they sing this song called Will I. This song to me is always so sad because like it really hits the heart of, I feel like, what a lot of people who deal with illness, especially illnesses that cannot be cured. I imagine even with like cancer, it hits the feelings that they might have about like, will somebody still be there for me? Will someone still love me and care for me? Make sure I'm okay. And so with this song, one thing that kind of stood out to me was they say like, will I lose my dignity? Will someone care? Will I wake up tomorrow from this nightmare, right? And so for me, that song kind of gets to me because I imagine like for a lot of people who had HIV, had AIDS, like a lot of it was like little by little, my body is like dying. And for a lot of them, they had like a lonely existence. Like nobody cared about them anymore. Like their family stopped showing up. They didn't, sometimes their friends that they had also had HIV. So maybe they had to nurse one person with HIV that passed away and then they're by themselves. So there's just like, for me, this song really elicited a lot of empathy for me, because I was like, man, like I can't imagine having to die alone from such a horrible disease. And I know at the end of the day, unfortunately, a lot of us end up in that space, whether it is like cancer, HIV for some people, whether it is dementia, whatever it is, like I know at some point, unfortunately, life is going to take us out. Like death is something that's inevitable. But I think this song really speaks to this desire that I think all of us have to like not die alone and to have somebody be there for us, right? And that there's dignity in our death, whatever that looks like, right? So this song always gets me in the feels because I'm like, man, like I want that for everybody. I want them to be treated with dignity. And it makes me sad that a lot of people who were living with HIV and died in the past during the epidemic didn't have that. And I imagine like this is something that probably is still going on in some communities even till this day. And for me, again, this was something that kind of breaks my heart. And so in this scene, we finally also see that Roger decides to join Mark, Angel, and Tom at this life support meeting. So it's kind of like a turning point for him. And you see that he finally kind of leaves the house. And then when they leave the group together, I think another thing that was kind of interesting is you kind of see them encounter a homeless woman, a Black homeless woman, who was being harassed by the police. And Mark, since he's doing his little video or his documentary, he's like, oh, this is a great time to film and call this out and maybe use it. And I love that this woman kind of like snaps at him and was like, oh, don't be trying to use my struggle in your film to make money. Because, you know, at the end of the day, she felt like a lot of people kind of use their poverty to profit off of it. And for me, as a person that strives for trying to, you know, pursue social justice and who cares about the plight of those who are marginalized, I thought this was like a very good call out, even though it was a very brief call out in this part, because I think a lot of the times, unfortunately, I do see this a lot in the nonprofit sector where it feels like, yes, these people come in with good intentions. Oh, we really want to help, blase, blase, blah. But what they're really doing is benefiting from the poverty of other people and filling their pockets, unfortunately. And I know this isn't all of the nonprofits, but I think a lot of them do it, that it makes sense that people like this Black woman was like, nah, I don't want you to use my face and my likeness to make this film happen. So yeah, so I did want to point that out, because I love that, again, that commentary kind of that this movie has about what it feels like or what it looks like for a lot of homeless people trying to live through and work through their condition and in being impoverished and not really having much options. And then there's also the reality that there's people that are pocketing off of it. And I mean, obviously this woman doesn't know that Mark is also like a starving artist himself. Or I mean, like she did kind of, but like, I would say like he has good intentions and he's trying to not just profit off of her situation. But at the end of the day, like if he did sell this documentary well, like he will kind of end up doing that. So I don't know. I just thought that was an interesting part. So quickly for the next two songs, Santa Fe was really cool because basically in this song, the group kind of takes a minute to like dream and imagine what it would be like to leave New York City, because it's how crazy New York City is, and maybe go to a town, Santa Fe, and open a restaurant. I think when I first watched this, I'm like, really, Santa Fe? I don't know what's out there in Santa Fe, but I thought that was an interesting place to imagine, but go off, like that's their business. And then after they get off of the train and they have this sequence of like singing about Santa Fe, Mark and Roger decide to leave to do a sound check for Maureen's protest, and Tom and Angel have a moment together where they sing the song called I'll Cover You. And throughout this song you kind of get to know a little bit more about their relationship in some ways and how much they love each other. And you basically get to see that they're falling in love. And I take it as like also that they're deciding at this point to kind of move into each other, because I know even the beginning of the song, Angel is like, live in my house, I'll be your shelter, just pay me back with 1,000 kisses, right? So for me, at least I got from this that, okay, we both love each other, let's move in together, right? And so for me, the hopeless romantic that I am, I'm like, ah, oh, so cute. And so after we get to see a little bit about this, we move on to the next song, Over the Moon. And here is where first Roger initiates like a conversation with Mimi outside of the protest area, just to kind of apologize and be like, yo, my bad. And then he ended up inviting her out to eat. And before all this happens, we also see Mimi buying drugs, which I was like, ooh, girl, you going through it. But she's buying. And so Mimi obviously accepts his apology and agrees to go out to eat with them. And then they all kind of walk together into the show. And again, Maureen starts performing her song Over the Moon, which is kind of interesting because it's, I feel like part of it is spoken word and then also her singing part. So I thought that was an interesting part. I will say this wasn't like my favorite song at all in this movie, but through this, you kind of get to hear some background of like how Maureen feels about Benny and the fact that Benny has changed because he got married, and that he's trying to close down the little tent city area that they have for the homeless community because he ultimately wants to build his studio. And so throughout this whole process of this song, she's basically calling him out, right? And during the protests, obviously, Maureen did everything that she could to keep it pretty civil. But there's a point where the police and some protesters, there was some friction. It turned into like a bit of a altercation. It does kind of hint at that maybe the police kind of initiated some of this, but whatever. I'm not going to park too long on that because I'm not trying to get canceled. But that was very telling, right? But anyway, so everybody ends up scattering from the protests because of basically there's like a violence that's kind of starts happening and arrests. So everybody runs. And I will say too, I was kind of chuckling because Joanne, Maureen's partner, you find out she's a lawyer. So watching her kind of be a part of helping with the lights and recording and all this stuff, I was like, this girl's kind of putting herself at risk because if some shit goes down, like, it might not end well for her in her career, but thank God nothing happens. But I chuckled at that part too when I was watching that. And so from here, we go to where everybody's kind of scatters. They meet together at a restaurant. I chuckled because when they first walk into the restaurant, the patron dude was like, no, like, please don't come in here. Because in the past, like, they weren't able to afford it or pay. So, of course, he sees them coming and he's like, hell nah, right? But they're able to pay because, again, Angel has some money. And I love this song, too, that comes up is La Vie Boheme, where they kind of talk about, at least from what I was in gathering from the song, it seems like this idea of La Vie Boheme is like a place where any type of person can be free, no matter your background, your sexual orientation, HIV status, whatever. Like, whoever you are, you free to be yourself. And to me, I kind of saw that and I was like, I like that. I like this idea of like creating a world or an environment that people can be feel free to love and be themselves and love who they want to love. So again, this song, again, caught my feels because I'm like, ah, so nice. But and then I also crackled some of this because you end up also finding out that basically the dog that ends up passing away because of Angel's drumming ends up being the dog of Benny. So I was like, that's so messed up. But basically through this song, La Vie Boheme, they end up letting Benny and the benefactors that he was like kind of sitting with or his investors know exactly what they feel about the bullshit that they're doing. So they do a lot of risque things, like the girls are kissing each other. They're talking about mutual masturbation. Like, they're talking about stuff that basically makes the everybody at that at Benny's table like cringe. Like, for me, again, my petty side kind of cracked up because I do think it's funny sometimes where, you know, let's make bigots and whatever feel uncomfortable because it's like, why not? if that's at least we could do, why not? So I think that song is funny because of that. So after they do that song, we find out that Roger and Mimi both have to take a break to take their medication. And it's like, they call it an ECT break, which is where they have to stop and take their meds for HIV. And during this moment of them taking a break, they're able to go outside and they sing this song called I Should Tell You, where they finally open up to each other and say, hey, we both have HIV. We both are falling for each other. And then they decide to be together. And then they walk back into the restaurant and everybody's like, yeah, we knew it. Which most of us who are watching this movie were like, yeah, we knew this was coming. So from there, we cue the montage of the group where, again, you see little clips and stuff of Roger's documentary kind of. So it's kind of cool. They have like grainy film of that in a way throughout this movie. And we get to see a little bit of the group. And then eventually we see this New Year's Eve scene where everybody's celebrating and they're sharing their resolutions. Some of them are. And then we also find out that Mark got a job offer from this place called Buzzline to produce like different segments and stuff, because Buzzline is basically like a news station, from what I remember. And because Mark basically gave them footage of the protests that happened and everything that happened afterwards, he ended up getting some money from them and they liked his content. So they're like, hey, please come work for us and do this, you know, full time. And so you kind of have a minute where you're like, you don't know if Mark is going to do it. And finally, I mean, later on, he ends up taking the job because unfortunately, when they get back home from their New Year's Eve celebration and it's New Year's Day, Benny basically ends up adding a padlock to their door in front of their apartment and they have to break it to like get into the place. And so they're like, shit, we got to come up with something. And so Maureen was like, well, you might as well get this job. And so Maureen and Joanne end up going into the office and helping him get the job. And I think the funny thing about that is, like, you end up seeing a little bit of Joanne and Maureen's dynamic during the time that they were going to figure out the job thing, because Maureen, she tries to go into the office with them, and Joanne is like, no, girl, like, it needs to be just the two of us, because it's kind of implied that if Maureen goes in with Joanne and Mark, maybe Maureen's presence will be too distracting, or maybe that she's not smart enough. At least I think that's what Maureen kind of received from Joanne saying, no, don't go. And so obviously from there, we kind of see, like, because Maureen is kind of insecure, she starts flirting with the secretary that she stays back with. And then Joanne is kind of distracted, like, from the meeting, because she's watching her girlfriend flirt with somebody else. And so I felt bad, but I was also kind of cracking up, because I'm like, this is a moment where it's like, you guys could have had a conversation about this, and maybe this could have helped, or maybe they've had, but we don't know that. But it's a glimpse of, like, their dynamic a little bit. And you see, like, even though Joanne is, like, very confident in her role as a lawyer, she's not really confident in her role as, I'm this girl's girlfriend and she really wants to be with me, because it seems like she has, like, a wandering eye type of thing. So you kind of start seeing some of their insecurities kind of play out in both, where Maureen is like, am I even good enough? Am I just my looks? Whatever. You can kind of see that. And then with Joanne is like, is she going to stay with me? You know, this type of thing. So from here, they go out into the streets and Mark gets the job. And Joanne and Maureen get into a little bit of an argument. And Joanne basically tells Maureen, like, I need from you commitment. Like, I need to know that you're committed to me, which I was like, that's fair. You know, like, I understand, like, when you're in a relationship, your eyes aren't necessarily broke, but you shouldn't be, like, ogling somebody else and flirting up a storm in a way that's disrespectful to your partner, right? So I understood where Joanne was coming from. But essentially, Maureen finally is like, look, marry me. Like, I want you to see that I'm committed to you. And so they get engaged and we transition to the next song, Take Me or Leave Me. This one is kind of one of my favorites because I think I just love the awkwardness of the scene, and then just the dynamic between these two women always make me laugh. But essentially, they're in, like, this hoity-toity restaurant type thing, and you can tell that between Joanne and Maureen, like, their backgrounds are very different, and that, like, Maureen is more like a free spirit. Maybe she doesn't have as much money and all this stuff, and then Joanne, she looks very, like, Ivy League. The parents are probably making a lot of money themselves, and the place is as rich as whatever. And Joanne is very, like, buttoned up and in control of everything and whatever. So you kind of see that dynamic, which is like, okay, that's interesting. And then from there, we kind of see Joanne's parents take some time to basically congratulate her daughter into finding someone that she loves, and then welcoming the other family into the fold and all that stuff. And everything, again, like I said, is so very hoity-toity, rich, whatever. And after everybody says their words and everything, I was kind of cracking up because you can kind of tell, like, Maureen is just feels like she's, like, trapped, or it looks like she feels like she's trapped. So she's just like, ooh, I need a drink. And so while she's going to get a drink, she's downing stuff. She starts flirting with the bartender, and that leads to them fighting and singing Take Me or Leave Me. And so both of them are going back and forth, kind of talking about their differences. And again, that's where you kind of get to see a little bit more about their dynamic. And that's where I feel like I kind of saw what it really comes down to is Maureen is very, like, free-spirited, loose. She wants to experience new things. She wants to be, like, kind of freaky in some ways, because I know she talks about wanting to go to some kind of, I don't know if it was, like, a bar, or, like, maybe it was, like, a shop that had some stuff that made Joanne uncomfortable. And she's like, well, I didn't do that because it made you uncomfortable. And she was saying that she didn't get her nipples pierced. It was, like, a whole thing. But, which, again, I think the absurdity of it is that they were having this fight with everybody present, right? But, again, you get to see their dynamics of, like, one is super controlled. One is very, like, I care about appearances. And then Maureen's like, I'm a free spirit. So they hash it out through this song. And by the end of the song, they decide, like, we're breaking up. This isn't working. And I think I laughed about this scene. I like the song. And their vocals are, like, really good to me. But I also thought it was one of those moments I'm like, I could not imagine having this fight with everybody watching me, like all of my family watching me. Like, I would have died, you know? So that in itself was like, oh God, why are you guys having this fight in front of everyone? And then after they had their fight and they break up, I was cracking up because Maureen's mother basically was like, oh, okay, now that they're done, Mark, maybe you can get back together. And the friends are like, oh girl, bye. So that scene altogether was pretty funny for me because I was like, damn, not only is it awkward that you guys are having this fight in front of everybody, but then Maureen's mother is like, oh, okay, like, Mark, let's get back in there. So, oh my God, that shit was funny. And so from here, we kind of start seeing, like, there's a transition to the song Without You, which the whole group of the cast starts singing. And so within this song, we start seeing some tension, some breakups. Obviously, the two women are no longer together. And Benny basically at first agrees to give them back their house because he had a conversation with Mimi. But that turns into some conflict between, like, Roger and Mimi, which at first I was like, I'm not sure why this was a conflict because they never really hinted at, like, Mimi, like, straying from their relationship. So that was kind of a weird thing for me. But maybe for me, I was like, hey, maybe there's something in the play that I didn't know and they had to make this work for time type of thing. But basically, you see montages, though, of Roger and Mimi kind of going through some conflict because Mimi keeps dabbling in using heroin. And obviously, Roger's trying to be like, no, this is not what you need. And it ends up leading to their breakup. And then also throughout this montage, you're seeing how poor Angel, unfortunately, is succumbing to his HIV. And he's dying, essentially. And so the group is trying to kind of deal with their internal shit, like their conflicts between each other, like within all the different relationships that are kind of breaking up. But then they're also trying to be there for Angel as he's passing away. And so that was really hard to watch because obviously you can see from the screen that they all love each other. But this is, like, unfortunately a reality of HIV. And so, like, it was nice to at least be able to see that they were able to be there for each other. And then the next song, I'll Cover You, Goodbye Love. This is where we eventually see that unfortunately Angel passes away and his funeral ends up being on Halloween, which is like a day that they kind of imply that he really liked. And I like this scene because you really get to hear the group share about how much Angel meant to them and how much Angel really poured into them and loved them. And his love kind of inspired them to love each other and do some things as well, as what is kind of implied, right? So this is one of the songs for me that I really, really love. Like, I think this one is probably one of my favorites, especially because of the guy who is with Angel, Tom. His voice is like, wow. His name is Jesse L. Martin in real life. But his voice kind of paired up with Tracy Toms, who plays Joanne. It always feels like church every time I hear them sing together because of how powerful and how it feels like a gospel song, kind of. And you can feel the depth of their emotion through this song for me. So I ended up loving I'll Cover You and Goodbye Love. Because first you kind of see through I'll Cover You, it's like another, I don't know if it would be like a remake or I think they call it like a reprise or something of the first time that Tom and Angel sang I'll Cover You. So to me, it kind of felt like Tom was remembering a moment, right, of where he and Angel were talking to each other and saying, like, I love you. I want you to move in with me. I'll cover you and I will take care of you through everything. And that's kind of a moment where you get to remember their relationship and, like, how they kind of ended up doing that for each other. And for Tom, it was kind of like I did this to the end for him, right? For Angel. At least that's how I took it. And then obviously they go through the funeral procession and they bury him and everything. And so part of this goodbye love part, you kind of see the dynamics of the group, how much it has changed. And obviously Maureen and Joanne are still kind of fighting with each other. You see that Roger and Mimi are still kind of fighting as well. And this is a moment where it's like, in a way, kind of a come to Jesus moment, it feels like for me, because like Angel's death kind of forces everybody to have the arguments that they kind of need to have, right? And so with Maureen and Joanne, they end up getting together. And then Roger and Mimi are still broken up. And it was really interesting with Roger and Mimi, especially for me, because you hear him say basically like, you have to learn to love yourself before you can love other people. And he also implied like their relationship was always like a three-way street, because Mimi was still struggling with her addiction, still struggling with other stuff, and then also trying to love Roger. And it was kind of like the two loves were competing, her love for drugs or her addiction to drugs and her love for Roger. And so I think for me, when I was watching this movie, it kind of spoke to that. And I was like, damn, like, that's really deep. Because he does, like I said, say, like, you can't really share real love until you learn to love yourself. And because she was struggling with everything else, it was hard for her to even love herself. And then let alone, like, figure out how to love Roger, right? So at the end of this funeral, everybody splits up. Like I said, Joanne and Maureen end up getting back together and making up. Roger ends up leaving for Santa Fe, which is so interesting because in the beginning of the movie, they're singing about Santa Fe and how much they wanted to go there. And then you see Mark ends up going back to his work with that company Buzzline, and he's like miserable. Tom goes off and does his own thing. They don't really show us that. And then it's kind of implied that Mimi not only battles with her addiction a little bit, but she tries to figure out rehab, and that ends up not going well. So then, you know, eventually we transition to What You Own. And that with that song, you kind of start to see Roger's realizing, like, I hate being in Santa Fe. I miss Mimi. He ends up being able to finally write a song. He eventually comes back because he realizes, like, I really miss Mimi. Mark is miserable at his job, so he ends up quitting. And they both kind of, Mark and Roger end up both at the roof and kind of reunited and realizing like, okay, oh, the things that I tried to figure out and tried to go to are not working. I want to go back to the things that I care about. And so for Roger, again, it's Mimi finishing his song, which he ends up doing. And for Mark, it's like finishing his documentary and actually focusing on that, right? And in this moment, like, we also later hear a little bit about how Mimi was going to rehab, but she ended up running away from rehab, and she's missing. She's not taking her meds. She's not going to work. Some people said that she was in the park, she was still doing drugs and all that stuff. And so the group kind of comes together and tries to look for her at different occasions. And to kind of bring it close to the end, like at the end of the movie, we end up back Christmas Eve, 1990. So it's like a year later of everything that's gone on. And Mark, Roger, and Tom kind of reunite. And you kind of find out that Colin stopped working at NYU, which is Tom Collin stopped working at NYU as a professor. And he has decided to kind of use ATM's codes to kind of make it so that if you type in Angel, you get free money, which that's awful. But I thought that was funny that he had that mind and kind of do that, right? And as they're kind of reuniting and celebrating all that stuff, you kind of find out that Joanne and Maureen end up finding Mimi at the park. And she's really like cold and sick and not doing well. And so everybody brings her upstairs to the house, put her on the table. And this is where we hit the point where it's like the finale, or like the song that they call Your Eyes. And you finally get to see that Roger and Mimi have their moment where they kind of apologize to each other. They finally admit that they love each other. And Roger admits that he came back because he loves her and he's sorry that he left in some ways and that he finally was able to write his song. And you find out that the song that he wrote was about Mimi, which I was like, cute, even though I was like not a huge fan of the song. And obviously they get back together. And but not before Mimi has a moment where you're like, oh shit, did she die? And she ends up waking up and saying like she was dying, but Angel was like, turn around, girlfriend, and listen to that song that this man wrote, which I thought was cute. And so in this moment is where the group comes together and sing their final song, No Day But Today. And Mark finally is able to show the group his documentary, and the friends kind of reunite and affirm like this sense of, we're going to be together, we're going to stick together, we're going to love each other, and we're going to continue to live for today, right? And so I really enjoyed this movie. I think it's okay, though, if you're a person that maybe watches this movie and you're like, ugh, this really isn't for me. That's totally fine. But again, I think given the time that I was in, especially since when I first learned about this movie, I was 15. I probably watched it like a year or two later or so. And so there were so many things that this movie brought up between like the HIV epidemic, the realities of homelessness, even what it looks like to be a starving artist and try to figure things out, understanding classism, elitism, all these different things that are surrounded around like the realities, I think, about like just having a capitalistic society and trying to survive. There were so many things in this movie that I was like, oh shit, like I never knew this. And so when I think about how this movie just changed the way I view things, I think for me, especially in the areas of homelessness and people that are struggling with HIV and people that are struggling with addiction, I was really challenged to just think more about like what got this person to this place. Because I think it's so easy, especially for me growing up in Florida, growing up in an evangelical circle, everybody was just like, oh, it's just their own moral failing. We just need to let them deal with it. Fuck them. Like, I feel like that was kind of the attitude. Even if we saw people on the streets who were asking for money and panhandling, the reaction was always like, oh, they're just going to do drugs. They're just going to do drugs. And for some people, maybe that's the case, right? But again, I think for me, watching this movie really forced me to really think about everybody's story. Like everybody's story is so different when it comes to what leads them to homelessness, what leads them to addiction, what leads them to having like diseases like HIV, that judgment should be the furthest thing from our mind, right? And also for me, I think it made me even think about the fact that we have a society that's really big on like the deserving poor and the underserving poor. And we kind of qualify, oh, these are these people that we're willing to help. And the rest are like, fuck them. And for me, especially as a person that looks at the teachings of Christ, and I see how much like within his teachings, he was never like that, right? It's not like Christ was like, oh, okay, I'm only going to come for these certain people and that's it. The idea of Christ coming is that he wanted to help everybody. He cared for everybody, right? And so when I hear people like kind of putting people into these different categories of like this person deserves this and this person doesn't deserve this, especially when it comes to poverty, homelessness, and sicknesses that people can't control, that irks me, right? So I think watching this film had awakened this challenge for me to look into people's stories and their histories a little bit more and be more willing to be empathetic and do my best to help them regardless of how they got to their certain situation, right? Because I think, God forbid, I end up homeless for whatever reason, or I end up catching some kind of disease for whatever reason, I wouldn't want somebody to put me in these categories of whether I deserve or not deserve help, right? And I wouldn't want to do that to anybody else as well, because again, I try to be empathetic. So I think this movie was really good for that. And then I think the last thing this movie really helped me with is even understanding a little bit more about the AIDS epidemic in general, because there's so much of our history with that that we never talk about. I think AIDS, for a while, I kind of just knew it as like something that some Black people get or something that people with LGBTQ identities maybe have had type of thing. And especially like gay men, I know that was a reality that a lot of gay men had it, right? And to me, even though I think when I think about statistics and all that stuff, historically, yes, the stats may be true that certain populations may have been affected by these diseases or these things a little bit more than others, right? But for me, I'm like, that doesn't mean that they're any less deserving of care and love and empathy and treatment and all that stuff. And it kind of felt like during that time, because they're like, oh, the queers have it, or oh, Black people have it, it was like, oh, we're not going to give a fuck about these people. They can just die of it and they can be condemned to whatever with this disease, right? But then the moment white people started getting it a little bit more, that's when we're like, oh God, it's a problem. And I think it's the same thing with like drugs, especially with like this epidemic that we're having with the opioid epidemic, right? When Black people are in these certain neighborhoods are like, oh, well, they're, you know, using drugs and they have crack, whatever. Then we're like war on drugs and we try to do all this crime and all this stuff. But now that white people are dying of overdoses and drug use and all that stuff, now it's like, oh, it's an opioid epidemic. We should care. And so, I mean, yes, there's a lot of racism and homophobia laced in this, and that's a problem. But again, I think in general, we should care more about people in general, no matter what background they have. Nobody deserves to die without dignity. Nobody deserves to not be given the best treatments available if those treatments are available. Even the fact that so many people have to work so hard to even get a little bit of like decent health care. For me as a social worker, that's always been a very hard and troubling thing, right? So yeah, so I think this movie really made me start to think about some of that stuff, because little me had no idea about this. I think I just grew up having these assumptions and these false myths and whatever's about these different communities, like kind of placed on my lap, and I just regurgitated because that was what was expected of me. But this movie kind of pushed me to explore a little bit and realign my thinking a little bit, right? And so that is kind of why I wanted to bring up this movie, because in general, I think for most people, you can look at this movie and you're like, oh, the music is pretty good. The actors are pretty good. There's some things here and there that you can like from a scene or two. But if you really take a time and think about some of the implications of this movie, I think this movie provides an opportunity for us to like learn, and not only learn, but also have questions that we can go away from this movie and be like, okay, let me look this up a little more. Let me take some more opportunities to figure out what this means or what this doesn't mean, right? And so that is part of why I wanted to share Rent as a possibility for you all to like watch and learn and maybe have an opportunity to grow from, type of thing. Because again, even though there's like pretty good cinematography, I'm not going to say great, so the film buffs don't come after me, but it has pretty good cinematography, pretty good music, choreography, all these different things, and you can get lost in all of that. But there's so many hidden like gems that you can learn about our society through this film that I really loved and enjoyed. And I hope that you guys, after listening to me talk about this movie a little bit, you'll be willing to go and listen to or watch and just try to see if you enjoy it as well. And of course, if you don't enjoy this movie, there's other great options as well that provides learning. Like I know Pose is a TV show that me and my good friend Diane might do eventually on this podcast that we've learned from. But the key is like, we can't be afraid to go out and learn about these communities just because it makes us uncomfortable, especially when it comes to drug use and gender identities or sexuality and stuff like that, because those things exist. And the fact that I had so many adults in my life in the past being like, oh, stay away from that, stay away from that. I'm like, but they exist. Like, just because I don't say the name of whatever it is, it doesn't make it go away. And I think it also speaks to like the don't say gay bill, for example, too. Just because I don't say gay or just because I don't want to acknowledge gay people, it doesn't mean it makes them not exist. They're still there. So it's better for me to be aware of them and understand who they are as people as much as I can and interact with them and figure out how to love them as human beings than me pretending that they're not there just to fulfill some kind of like bigotry or hatred towards them that really doesn't serve us in the long haul, right? It just continues to take away from our humanity and members of the LGBTQ identity as well. So I don't know. With that said, I hope that you were able to get some good nuggets from this episode. I do encourage you all, if you are interested in musicals at all, or if you're just interested in this movie, check it out. Share your thoughts with me. Of course, like I said, my email is connect@sosessionswithneff.com. Please feel free to share your thoughts with me, or you can hit me up on Instagram, which is Soul Sessions with Neff. And yeah, so please don't be afraid to just keep the dialogue going. If you agree, disagree, that's fine. But I just want us to really have some space to really think about how we can use simple things, even like this musical, to talk through topics that are a little bit more complex and are worth us really investigating and talking about, right? And so with that said, please enjoy my outro. Please don't forget to rate and write a review for me. Just let me know what you think about these episodes, okay? So until next time, of course, this is Critical Reads and my outro is coming on now. Hey there, and thank you for joining me on this week's episode of Critical Reads. To find out more about me or to consume more of my content, please feel free to visit my website, soulsessionswithneff.com, where I share a variety of things, including blog posts, resource lists, and have a regularly updated calendar for this podcast. You can also follow me on Instagram and Facebook using the handle @soulsessionswithneff. While you're at it, if you really enjoy listening to Critical Reads, I encourage you to please subscribe to this show on iTunes, Google, or Spotify, and take some time to rate us on these different platforms. Your reviews will really help the show gain some visibility and also give me some much-needed feedback on how the show is doing. I thank you in advance for your time and your support, and until next time, this has been Neff with some Critical Reads.